Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
My guest on today's show is one of the hottest new comedians on the stand-up scene. And I hope this doesn't make you feel super old, but she's still 3 years away from turning 30.
I am halfway through my 20s and I am done with this shit. Oh my God, I'm sick of my 20s. I'm so sick of people telling me to enjoy them. They're not fun. They are 10 years of asking yourself, will I outgrow this or is it a problem? Like, is this a phase or a demon? I just need to know. Like, am I fun or should I go to a meeting? Someone help me.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and that was Taylor Tomlinson from her seriously funny stand-up special, Quarter Life Crisis. Taylor's debut hour premiered on Netflix on March 3rd, 2020, about a week before most of the country was stuck inside looking for stuff to watch. But for a while, she wasn't sure she'd ever have the chance to build on her sudden success. A year and a half later, Taylor is finally out touring her next hour, which is expected to hit Netflix sometime next year. And as she tells me on today's show, she can't quite believe that she has achieved her wildest dream of performing comedy for actual fans of her work. Let's just say she has come a long way from her inauspicious start as a teenage church comedian. Okay, let's get into it. Here's me with Taylor Tomlinson.
Boom. On the record, officially.
So are you back in New York now after, I know you've been on the road. Are you getting a few days off or where are you in the whole scheme of things now?
I am. I'm back in New York. We had the first weekend of the theater tour this past weekend. So I was in Minneapolis for three shows and then I went to St. Louis for a couple shows on Saturday and I got back to New York last night. So I'm still kind of like, I'm in a different time zone, like every 2 days because I go between LA and New York. And then on the weekends I'm in one to two different cities. So it's been a lot. I think the pandemic made me go like, I'll never complain about traveling again.
Yeah.
And I still feel that way, but it is a lot.
Yeah. So I was looking back, we talked, the last time we talked was like week one of the pandemic. If you remember this, I talked mm-hmm. to you and Sam Morrell when you were doing your new couple gets quarantined Instagram video series.
What movie do you want to watch?
We could watch Contagion. It's trending.
No way.
Why not?
Because we're in the midst of a tragedy. You need some distance before it becomes entertainment. That'd be like if the Jews watched Schindler's List during the Holocaust.
Want to watch Schindler's List?
I could do that.
And just crazy how much has happened since then. but yeah, I mean, I guess just to start going back to that series, how did that all work out? Because it seemed like it was a kind of a fraught situation with the being quarantined with your new boyfriend during the pandemic.
Oh yeah, I mean, we'd been together I think like 5 months when quarantine hit, and we got along surprisingly well in quarantine. It got kind of tough when we had to like be apart again, because he went back to New York after like 5 months of being together every day and every night. And I cannot believe that he was not home for 5 months during the most stressful time in history. And yeah, it was a lot of adjustment. I had a moment where I was like, I don't think I can do a long distance thing. Like, this is too hard for me. Cause it is, it's really, really hard. And so we broke up for a little bit and then we got back together, you know, as things were getting a little more hopeful. And I certainly needed that time for some personal growth, which is a nice way of saying like you had some things to work on, Taylor, as far as your personality goes. But yeah, and now we just go back and forth between New York and LA, and we're both on the road every single weekend. So I've been in New York more than he's been in LA. And I do like it a lot. I mean, are you based in New York or LA?
I'm in LA.
You're in LA. Okay.
But I did live in New York for a long time. So I kind of have experienced both.
Did you like it or did you hit a wall with it? I mean, everybody seems to have different experiences with it.
I for sure hit a wall with New York. By the time I left, I'd lived there for 10 years.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, that was enough. I feel like right. I got it. And and LA was more my speed by that point, just in where I was in my life. But yeah, it's, I mean, I loved New York. I love going back. And I haven't been back for like 2 years. But
and where are you from originally?
I'm from Boston, so I'm East Coast originally. Okay. But now I've been out here for like almost 9 years. So now I feel like I've been here as long as I was in New York almost. But yeah, you're from LA, right? So you,
I'm from California, not like LA proper, but I grew up in California.
Yeah. So how are you enjoying living in New York? Is this your first time like really living in New York?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think there are so many people who are like, I love to visit. Visiting is great. And
that's how I feel now.
Yeah. And I was talking to my friend, Kelsey Cook, who's also, you know, very funny comic. And she was going back and forth for a long time, for years, and almost moved to New York. And she loved it for like years. And then she also kind of hit a wall. So I don't know how it's going to go. I'm kind of like, New York's like sort of trying to prove itself to me right now.
Yeah.
I'm like, let's see if you're somewhere I could live. I talked to somebody last night where I was like, do you like it here? He'd been here like for 12 years. And he was like, it's very up and down. It's like, sometimes you're like, this is the most magical place on earth. And then other times you're like, this is a garbage city. So it seems very all over the place.
Yeah. I mean, I just watched Sam's new documentary that he put out, The Full Capacity, which made me kind of nostalgic for New York. Of course, in that documentary, you guys were talking about how you were broken up, which was kind of funny. So that just came out now that you're back together. But the documentary is really about getting back on stage in New York and the clubs reopening. Is that, since you're on, just started your tour, have you been sort of part of that scene at all? Or are you kind of, do you feel like separate from it because you're doing these, you know, big theaters now all over the country?
Yeah, I don't feel super ingrained in the New York comedy scene. When I'm in town now, I don't do as many in-town spots as I used to, because, you know, we just started doing this theater run. But when I was doing clubs, I mean, for the first time in my career, we're like adding shows to the point where like we're doing three on Saturday and the first one's at 4 p.m. And so to come home after doing like 7-8 hours, you know, over the weekend, at a certain point, you're like, I'm kind of tired. And I have to see my family and I have to record a bunch of podcasts. And I have all these other things that I have to take care of that are also work. And I can't be doing like four spots a night anymore like I used to. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, when I'm in town and I have a minute, like I like to do the Cellar or Gotham or the Stand or whatever. But I think I'd have to be here for a little while, like on the weekends and stuff too, to really feel like I could find a rhythm here. But when you're bouncing around like this, it's hard to find a rhythm anywhere. I mean, and even in LA, I get texts from people I know who run shows in LA or like clubs every week for avails in LA. And I'm like, I'll be back in a month. Like, can
does
I hit you
anything?
Up in a month? Yeah. Is a month from now good? My life is very different than it used to be. In that I used to have like one weekend off a month and I don't necessarily even have that anymore. So it's been interesting for sure, but I feel very lucky and very grateful to be where I'm at. But I think with this job, you have to learn how to prioritize your health, because I've learned the hard way that if you run yourself into the ground, taking like red eye flights and doing every possible show, you're going to end up losing time and money later, because you have to cancel a bunch of stuff when you are truly unraveling.
Yeah. Overcommitting yourself is not where you want to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would love to kind of just start at the beginning of your career, because I think you've had such an interesting trajectory, you know, over the past 10 years or so, and, you know, leading up to where you are now. So you know, I think some people, if there's a thing, something that people know about you, it might be that you started as a church comic, which is something that, you know, I don't think a lot of people even knew existed. But what was your material like at the beginning? And can you just talk a little bit about how you ended up, you know, performing in that world?
Yeah, it is something people don't know exists. I mean, that's the funny thing about stand-up comedy is there's like a lot of different ways you can make money as a stand-up comedian. Everyone's like, oh, it's so hard to make it. It's like, yeah, but there are other avenues. Like there are cruise ship comedians, there are church comedians, there are corporate comedians. Like I have done stuff in like kind of every different area and seen the different types of careers you could have. And the way I got started was not very cool, but is interesting. And then it's different. My dad wanted to take a stand-up comedy class. And so he decided to take me to that when I was a junior in high school. And so that's how I got started. But it was taught by a Christian comedian. His name's Nazareth. cannot make that up.
Yeah.
Real guy. And he taught this stand-up class at a church like 30 minutes from where we lived. And it was like me and like five other middle-aged people who were just like looking to spice up their teaching or something.
Yeah. Well, what do you think what was your dad's intention of doing the class? And was he going to do it on his own and with the idea of doing comedy? And then you kind of tagged along, or how did that happen?
I don't even know. There was a woman at our church who told him that she was going to do it. And I don't know if she said Taylor should do it, cause I was into like drama and stuff. But yeah, I remember at the time he said something like, I remember at one point he said something like, I didn't know you'd take to it like that. I thought, you know, yeah, you're a great writer and like you could write jokes for me or something. But I don't think he ever thought he was going to be like a comedian. He just thought it would be a fun thing to do. I mean, he has, you know, a career, but yeah, I don't know. I don't think he thought I was going to be a comedian. He
I
just
know,
thought,
that's what I was
this
thinking.
Will be fun.
Like, he never could have imagined that you would have taken it this far from the first stand-up comedy class.
No, probably wishes I didn't. And, but yeah, so that's how I got started. And that guy started having me open for him or sending me to do church shows that were like, you know, not at his level or whatever. Cause you know, he's doing it professionally and making a good living and had a family and whatnot. So I started, and the first 2 years I was doing it, like 16 to 18, it's not like I could go up in comedy clubs. I wasn't allowed inside of them. So I was just doing like churches and coffee shops and, you know, more like weird side corporate-y things. Like it was just, it was very like pieced together and inconsistent. And obviously I had homework.
what was your material like at that time, you know, when you're 16, 17 years old performing comedy?
Very self-deprecating. I had very low self-esteem and obviously very clean. And I didn't have any church jokes because even at that time, I was like, I don't want to be like a church comedian. And I saw a lot of church comedians like only doing church jokes. And I just didn't want to do that. So I had a lot of like, I didn't go to prom, what a loser I am. Like jokes about my appearance and jokes about the fact that I was so young doing it and how people probably didn't expect me to be good and I'm sorry. And it was really like, I watch old clips sometimes and I'm like, I think I'm making people sad in this one. Like it's a weird place to get not even good. I don't know if I even got good, but to start practicing stand-up because church audiences or like clean shows, they are very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
And the most important thing is that you're clean.
Yeah.
And so the only way you're going to bomb is if you do anything edgy.
Yeah. Was that tempting to do something edgy and bomb?
No, it really wasn't, because I was such a like straight A goody two shoes. But once I got to be like 21, mm-hmm, I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to be like kind of shackled to this. And then by the time I was 22, I got fired from a church gig and I was doing so few at that point, but I got fired from one for like something I tweeted. And I was like, this is ridiculous. Now I'm like, what did that church person think they were? Like SNL? Like that's ridiculous. So I got to
you
a point
got,
where
you
I
got
just,
canceled by church.
I got canceled by a church comic. And yeah, I had already been kind of like easing out of it. But yeah, it was a super weird start. But I hadn't even seen a show in a comedy club until I was 18. So when I was 18, I went to the Ice House in Pasadena. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, this is how it's supposed to sound. It's like the only stand-up show I've ever gone to and sat in the audience. And I was like, oh, this is it. This is how it's supposed to be. And what I've been doing.
Was there anyone there that night that we would know or that you remember who made an impact on you?
Oh yeah. I went to see Marin because obviously I was listening to his podcast, trying to figure out how to be a comedian, as most of us were. And then Maria Bamford was featuring.
It's a good show.
Yeah. And then Eddie Pepitone was on it. It was like a crazy show. It was so good. And it was like, I don't even think I laughed the whole show. I think I just sat in the back with two of my friends from high school going like, oh my God, just like frozen. Just like, oh no, I want to be this instead.
Is that sort of the moment where you saw it as a career for yourself or something that you really wanted to pursue as opposed to sort of a hobby, a high school hobby?
Yeah, I think I had really bad anxiety too. And I was like, please let me just want to do the easy thing. Like, I don't want to want this life because I know it's going to be hard and scary. And I think it would have been a relief to go to a comedy club and go like, nah, this isn't for me. And just go back to doing churches and not disappointing my family with my material. But that wasn't what happened. And thank God it all worked out on some level.
Didn't the tweet that got you canceled from the church gig ended up in your special, right? Or in one of your sets?
Yeah, it ended up in my Conan set. I think I might have done it in the 15, comedy lineup on Netflix too. But yeah, it ended up in a set. So I was like, worth it.
Even today, I'm, as an adult, very sexually conservative. Not that I'm bad at sex, okay? I'll have you know in bed, I am a wild animal, all right? Yeah, way more afraid of you than you are of me.
So in terms of when you sort of became more sort of mainstream professional or in that transition, was Last Comic Standing something that kind of came during that time, or was that a big deal in that transition from churches to mainstream?
You know, it's funny because Last Comic Standing, they did a few like background shoots on a few comics. And for mine, they were like, we think it's so interesting that you started in churches. We would love to film you performing at a church. And I was like, okay, but can we make it clear that I'm not like a church comedian, that this is just something I do sometimes, and like kind of how I started. Cause at that point I had just turned 21 and I was like, I don't want to be branded that way or whatever. And they were like, for sure, yeah, for sure. And that was before I knew how reality television worked. So I was like, okay, sure. And it was like the one they filmed too was like me performing at a morning service. I think I got a gig to do like a Mother's Day service. And I had never performed in the morning at a church ever. I had only done like comedy nights they had on like a Friday or Saturday. And so it was just it was just a caricature of what is already a very uncool look for a stand-up comedian. And it came out, and of course, it was just like, this is a church comedian. Like, it was very,
it was not what you wanted.
Edited. No, it's not what I wanted. I don't even think I watched the whole show. I don't even think I watched myself on it because it's hard to watch yourself anyway. But yeah, it was not what I would have chosen at all. But it came out of nowhere. It was not something I was like trying to get on. I don't even think I knew it was coming back. And I had just turned 21 and I had just like quit my job and gone full time because I did NACA conferences and booked all these college shows. And so I was on the road doing colleges right after my 21st birthday. And like a producer just emailed me and was like, we found you on YouTube. Can you come audition for it in LA? And I flew back to LA for exactly like 20 hours, did the audition. And then the next week they called me and they're like, yeah, can you come do the show in a couple months? So
yeah, I've talked to a lot of comedians who've been on that show and it never seems like it was a good experience in the end somehow.
Yeah. It wasn't my favorite. Look, they were very nice to me, but also it's a reality show and it's a competition show. And, you know, people will tell When I say this, people will say like, no, it's because you're good. I'm like, I wasn't that good. You know, like I should not have been in the top 10 like I was. But it's a reality show and it's a good story to be the youngest person on that show and have like an interesting backstory. So it doesn't feel like that good to get it because you're like, this isn't a great representation of who the actual top 10 best comedians were in the 100 they saw. Because I'm here.
You know, once you started, you know, not doing churches anymore, not being exclusively clean anymore, what was that process like for you of figuring out who you were as a comedian if that wasn't your brand, if that wasn't your identity?
It was tough because I think at the same time I was trying to figure out if I was religious or not. And the truth is I didn't feel like I was for a really long time, but my entire family is very Christian. So I didn't feel like I could exit Christianity without losing my family. And so I was kind of hanging on to it for a long time, but I felt a lot of guilt because I felt like I wasn't who I said I was, and I didn't believe what everyone else did, and I just didn't have that same conviction. And it was a slow process. It was probably a few years from when I was, I don't know, like 19 or 20 until like 22 that I was really struggling with it. But then once I kind of just accepted it, it got a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. Was there a joke or a bit or something that kind of unlocked it for you that where you were like, this is the direction that I want to go in from where I was before?
There was one specific joke. I think I just wanted to start talking about different things. You know, the new hour I'm doing, for example, there's a large chunk about losing my mom as a kid. And even stuff like that, even if it's not dirty, doing like darker material in cleaner spaces doesn't work either. And I was like, well, if I can't, not only can I not swear, I can't talk about real stuff. And I don't have a family and I don't have kids. Like, I'm not a 50-something dude with a wife and kids who goes to church every weekend. I'm just, and that's who's doing these like church and corporates. And I don't have an hour about cruise ships either. There was a year I did like 8 cruise ships and I was like, this is a nightmare. I'm glad I know what this is, but this is rough. So yeah, I don't know that there was a specific bit, but yeah, at a certain point, I think that joke that I got fired for was a big moment. And the fact that it ended up on Conan and Netflix, I was like, all right, I'm going the right direction.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that you mentioned the Netflix comedy lineup, which is the 15-minute special, which I'm sure was a big deal when you got that. Did that feel like a big turning point, big break moment for you when you got that opportunity?
Yeah, that felt huge. I had been submitting for the half hour on Comedy Central, I think for a couple years. And then the Netflix 15 became a thing. And I don't even know if they're going to do it again, but I got the offer to do that and then the Comedy Central half hour the same year. And I was like, well, I should obviously go do the Netflix one.
Was that that was an easy decision?
Yeah, I think that was a pretty easy decision.
Just because of the reach of it, or what was your thinking there?
Yeah, definitely because of the reach of it. But it was weird because you have these goals coming up as a comedian because, you know, growing up, you're like, I watched those Comedy Central half hours when I was in high school. And so you want to do everything that you saw in high school, but then you get it or you do it and everything sort of changed. I mean, Last Comic Standing was like that, where I watched that as a kid. And then I got there and I was like, I mean, it's cool that I'm on the thing I was watching, but it's not the same. It's not the same show as it was when I was younger, and doesn't do the same things for your career. So
yeah, I feel like there's an older generation that would always choose the longer one. You know, it's like, oh, if someone's offering me 30 and someone's offering me 15, I'm just going to take the 30 without thinking about the implications of it. And obviously there were huge implications for you taking that 15-minute special on Netflix, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, the half hours, it was like, no matter how good this is, it's going to be hard for people to watch unless you have television.
Cable.
And a lot of people did. Yeah. And a lot of people just have Netflix and Hulu and all that other stuff. So for me, it was a pretty easy decision. And it really made a big difference in my career and helped on the road. And obviously nothing like the hour did, but it was also a stepping stone in helping me get the hour.
Right. Yeah. Did you think about, you know, you have this 15 minutes on Netflix that has the potential to be seen by this huge audience. Is that a lot of pressure to either stand out amongst that lineup or introduce yourself in a way that leads to things? Because it is just like, it's a lot on 15 minutes.
It is a lot on 15 minutes. It's a lot of pressure. I think I just went into it going, I'm going to put my strongest jokes that I have right now in this 15.
It's fine. I know what it is. I got a real bad case of I'll raise your baby face. Just very wholesome. We're just round and white like a chore wheel with eyes. Men don't even picture me naked. They just picture me helping their mom on Easter. Not that I think I'm ugly. I think I'm pretty cute, but in an accessible way. Like when you see a shower curtain at Target and you're like, I could afford that.
And yeah, I did put thought into that. I mean, originally I had like a different jacket I was going to wear that was like a very distinct color because I was like, well, if people aren't going to remember my name if they watch this series, but if they're telling their friends which ones to watch and they liked me, it'll be easier for them to go, oh, watch that girl in the pink jacket, you know?
Yeah.
And then I got there and I think I tried it on and it just like didn't look right on camera or something, or they didn't like it. And I just ended up wearing like the jacket I came in on the plane because they were like, this looks better. And I was like, all right, that's fine. And it was not a very distinctive jacket, but it did the job. So it's
yeah,
fine.
It turned out the jacket was not as important as the material.
Right. Turns out, and also part of it is stuff you can't control, which is like where they put you in the lineup of episodes. I mean, I lucked out in that I was they released it in two parts and I was like the third one of the first part, which is a pretty good spot, I would say.
And that led pretty directly to your hour, Quarter Life Crisis, on Netflix, right?
Yeah. After we did the 15, I was like, well, I would really like to do the half hour on Netflix. But I was doing, you know, I was headlining clubs. And so I was like, I don't know how to get 30 minutes on tape. And I kind of talked to my team about it and they were like, well, just get the hour, you know, who knows, maybe they'll give you an hour. And I was like, there's no way they give me an hour. But if I show them that I can do an hour, maybe they'll go, oh, there's plenty to choose from here for the half hour. So I sent them an hour and my manager believes in me more than I believe in myself. And she was like, she's like, I'm going to talk to them about an hour. And I was like, all right, like that's, if you want to waste your time, go for it. And, I think it was like 4 months we waited to hear back. And then I think I submitted it in February and we found out in June that they were giving me the hour. And it was like, it was so cool for like 30 minutes. And then I was terrified.
Yeah. What made you so terrified?
I just didn't want to blow it. I know how long and hard people work to get an opportunity like that. And I have been very fortunate and very lucky. I'm not saying like I'm not good at stand up, but I have been very lucky in my career to get things fairly early. And so that's never lost on me. And I never want to take that for granted. So I think I felt a lot of pressure to rise to the occasion and be worthy of the opportunity.
Coming up, Taylor opens up about what it feels like to achieve so much at such a young age, and how she's had to start thinking up new dreams for the rest of her career.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Thank you. If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. We have had so many incredible stand-up comedians on this show, including Whitney Cummings, Anthony Jeselnik, Nicole Byer, and Taylor Tomlinson's boyfriend, Sam Morell. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to those episodes and everything else from our free archive, and you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Taylor Tomlinson. One of the reactions to your hour that I heard was sort of like, how did she get so good, so polished, so young? Which is sort of a compliment, but it's kind of like a complicated compliment. And so I'm wondering, did you feel that, and how did you receive that when you heard that?
I think I get it. I think I would probably feel the same way. I mean, most people don't know I started when I was 16. So we filmed it. I've been doing it about 10 years, but it's different than like 10 years grinding it out in clubs. Like, I didn't have the normal trajectory. I think it's totally understandable that people would be like, what? And I'm glad that they're saying, how did you get so polished, instead of, why do you even have that? Like, you're not even good enough to have this. So I'm so fine with it.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, there's worse things people could say.
Right. Exactly.
So you had this very surreal experience, I'm sure, of the special being released in, it was March of 2020, right? That it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just sort of like just in time for everyone to be inside watching Netflix.
Yeah, exactly.
for longer than we thought we would be. But there's a positive in that, I guess, but at the same time, you couldn't kind of capitalize on this buzz that you were getting by touring and playing shows. So what was that like for you to have this special come out, have a lot of people watching it, talking about it, but kind of being stuck inside?
It was weird. You know, on one hand, you had my agent going like, it's a great time to have a special right now. People are just watching literally anything. They will watch whatever is on TV because
they're out of stuff to watch. Yeah.
They're out of stuff to watch, and they might give you a chance and they wouldn't have. But I'm sure that helped. I'm sure it helped to be a new thing on Netflix a week before quarantine hit. But yeah, I had a lot of fear about it because I was like, I don't know how long this is going to last. Once we realized it was probably going to be like a year plus, like I started to feel like, well, I probably missed my window because people are going to forget this even came out. Like, this will be something people watch for a few months and then it'll be forgotten about. And I'm proud of what I did.
You didn't want to be like Tiger King.
Exactly. I thought I was going to be Tiger King. I thought I was going to be comedy Tiger King. And yeah, I did some outdoor shows in the fall, and then like maybe one club weekend, two club weekends that were at like 40% capacity, and starting to see that I was actually selling tickets was like, oh, that's a little weird. And then didn't go on stage again for like another 3 months.
Yeah, that's tough.
It's weird, yeah. So I couldn't really, the only indication I got that people were watching it was social media, but you don't know if that's going to translate to ticket sales. So once I got back on the road in like February, I mean, we've sold out like every weekend, and it's insane. It's completely different than where I was before.
That's which wild. Was like, yeah.
Yeah. Some people would come to see me on purpose, but for the most part, you know, people were like, yeah, we watched your Fallon set and we thought you were funny, so we came and saw you. And just to be going up for crowds that are like, no, we came on purpose and none of us got a free ticket emailed to us that made us go, sure.
Yeah, yeah. So you opened that special, I believe, with the bit about being an introvert, which I think is just interesting also given the pandemic and people, you know, sort of introverts thriving during this past year and a half. Did you feel that, or did you want to be getting out and being more social during this time?
I just wanted to be working. It wasn't so much like I miss being social. It was like I just miss being at work. And, you know, so much of for I think most stand-up comedians, so much of your self-worth is tied up in your job. And so that was really hard during quarantine to be like, who even am I without this thing? Like, am I worth talking to even, like, without this? Like, do I have to find hobbies now? At one point I was like, should I go back to school? Like, should I just finish my degree? Like, should I do it online right now? Like, am I not going to be able to do this job when things come back? Cause it's going to be super competitive and only famous people are going to be able to do it. Like, I really did not know what to expect. And I have terrible anxiety and thought the worst possible thoughts and was like, yeah, if I even survive this. So yeah, it was tough. It was really tough. But yeah, I wasn't like, I wish I could go out and party. I didn't feel like that.
Yeah. I always wonder what, you know, how being an introvert squares with being a stand-up comedian who goes up on stage and, you know, you have to be confident enough to talk in front of crowds for long periods of time.
Yeah. Yeah. It is weird. And the new hour I'm doing is like a lot more personal. And I've just noticed after shows, I'm like, I feel more tired than I was before. And I think it's just because I am sharing a lot. I am sharing a lot. And you forget how much you're sharing because you're so focused on getting the laughs. But then once it's done, you're like, oh, everybody in there knows more than my parents do about me at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I imagine you're playing much bigger venues now than you were used to playing before your special came out. But at the same time, you're doing this more sort of darker, more intimate material. So how has that been playing to these bigger crowds, but kind of trying to talk about darker stuff?
You know, it's been great. I was nervous about it. I didn't know. I'm not doing like 10,000 seats or anything. So I don't know that it would work in a situation like that. But the theaters I'm doing are like, the largest one I'm doing, I think, is like 1,800. And most of them are like 1,000 to 1,200 or something. So it still feels intimate enough. And also, like, doing it in clubs is hard. People are eating chicken fingers.
Yeah.
Like, people are ordering drinks while you're like, and then my mom died. Like,
yeah, I guess in a theater, people are used to seeing, you know, heavier stuff.
Yeah, it's actually better. Again, I was intimidated by like the volume of people in the room, but it is a lot easier when you have everybody's full attention. But I'm glad I worked it out in clubs so that it's so dialed in, because in a club, like, it really has to be funny and like punchline dense to keep people's attention. Otherwise they're gonna just be focused on their food and booze.
Yeah. I don't know how comedians do these, like, you know, Madison Square Garden venues and huge, you know, stadiums. And, you know, is that something that you would want to try to do, or does it just seem like insane?
No, I really don't. That's the thing that like promoters or your agents or whatever will say is like, well, you know, someday you'll get to do Madison Square Garden. And you're like, I don't even think that's a goal I have. Like, I think there are certain comedians, like, you know, like Sebastian, that makes sense. But I don't think that I could pull that off. I don't think I could do Madison Square Garden and have it be as good a show as if I did, you know, a few shows in like a much smaller place. But yeah, I think certain people it works for, but I don't know that I have that act.
Beyond the next hour, what are your sort of ambitions in this business? Are there other things that you want to do, that you're planning to do, that you're excited about?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we're developing something right now that, again, you know, fingers crossed gets made, but is very personal to me and I'm very excited about, and we finally found the right combination of people to work with on it. And that I'm really excited about. It's early on, so I don't want to jinx it or anything, but I'm very focused on that. And
more of like a scripted thing, or?
Mm-hmm, yeah. And I mean, all I've ever wanted to do was tour theaters and like have people come and see me on purpose. So it's weird. I mean, this last weekend, I did my first show in Minneapolis on Thursday, and I was just like floating over my body the whole time. Cause I was like, oh, this has been in my head for so long. Like, the last time I was in a theater this size, I was opening for Brian Regan. Like, this is just something I've been dreaming about for a long time. So it's bizarre to be inside your dream. I mean, it's like having a crush on somebody for years and then they ask you to prom and you're just slow dancing. Like, am I going to wake up? Is this a prank? Like, it just doesn't feel real.
Yeah. It's also like, what do you do when you've achieved the highest dream that you thought? Do you have to come up with new dreams? Do you have to come up with new goals?
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess I do. I have that other project that I'm excited about, and that feels like enough for right now. Or I'm like, I just want to get this special done. I want that to be better than the last hour. And I want to make this project that I feel strongly about. And I want to not go crazy while doing all of it. So, you know, it's just this very long game of Tetris in this business where you're like, okay, where can I move stuff around? Where can I stop doing something? Where, because like you do a theater tour, it's completely different. Like I've never had merch before because I was like, I'm not going to make a shirt. And everyone's like, you should, you could sell shirts in a comedy club. And I'm like, I'm not going to make a shirt. Like, who am I? And now it's like,
now you have a shirt.
Yeah. Now there's like a tour shirt and you're like, okay, I get like, there's just, they're like sending me emails. Like, what do you want the lighting to be? I'm like, I don't know. Should we turn them on? Like it's
bright,
bright. Yeah, exactly. Can we do bright? Is bright good? So, you know, we'll see. I'm trying to get used to it. And again, be worthy of it because my biggest fear is that I get opportunities and then I get comfortable and then I become somebody that everybody looks at and goes, oh, you just kind of phone it in and you're not good enough for what you're doing. And, you know, all those things in your head that make you work harder.
I think those are in your head. I don't think anyone's saying that.
Not yet. But if I slip at all, yeah, it's a lot.
So now what I want to do is our final segment of the show, which is called The First Laugh, which is I'm going to ask you a bunch of sort of questions about firsts in your life and career. Just starting with the first piece of comedy that you remember making you laugh really hard, whether it was a movie or a TV show or a stand-up comedian that you saw on TV or anything that really made you laugh as a kid.
As far as stand-up goes, I'm sure someone else has said this before, like Dane Cook was huge when I was like 10. He was like the biggest you could ever be. And I didn't even know what stand-up comedy was, but like that's what everybody was obsessed with when I was like in fifth, sixth grade. And I do remember like listening to that Kool-Aid bit with a friend of mine during like a sleepover and we just could not breathe. We were laughing so hard at like 10 years old. And again, I'm sure other things made me laugh as well, but like that, I didn't know what stand-up was.
Mm-hmm. And then you heard that.
I don't even think I knew after I heard that. Yeah, I think it was another couple years. Yeah, I think it was another couple years before I saw it on YouTube and was like, who? They're just standing there with a microphone? What's everybody sitting down for? So I heard his album with friends of mine who were like, you have to listen to this. And I don't remember knowing what it was because I grew up very sheltered. So I think I was just like, this is funny, whatever it is.
When was the first time that you felt like you were funny?
I think I felt like I was funny. I think it was around the same time. I think like fifth grade. I had just moved. I lost my mom the year before. I was like the new kid at school. And we had like a camp field trip, like an overnight field trip. And there was some night where we did like a talent sketch show. And I remember I did some sketch with my cabin and I was funny in that. And it was kind of the first time I had made anybody laugh because I was so quiet and scared. And I was like, that feels pretty good. But I didn't think I was like the funny kid growing up or in school because I was just so nervous and scared. And then once I got to like middle and high school, I think I was funny to my friends, but I wasn't like this class clown. I won class clown my senior year of high school, but I think it was like on the paper for voting, it was like funniest. And so a lot of people voted me funniest because I knew I did stand up, but then it came out and it said class clown. And I was like, this isn't right. This isn't what it is.
What do you remember about the very first time you told jokes on stage in front of an audience? Was that the sort of as part of that class?
Yeah, there was a graduation show that we did that was just, you know, all of our friends and families wanting us to do well so that they wouldn't be embarrassed for us. So again, pretty supportive crowd.
Yeah,
to be going up in front of.
So it went well for you that first time?
Yeah, it went well. I mean, it's, you know, it's again, as easy as it could have been is what it was. This is a lot of people rooting for the six of us.
What about the first joke that you wrote that you felt like really worked, really connected with an audience?
I don't know. I used to open with a joke about how young I was, where I said, like, I get that I'm really young, you guys, and there might be sort of a generational gap here. Because when you guys saw Titanic, you were sad because Jack died. When I saw Titanic, I was sad because Leonardo DiCaprio didn't look like that anymore. And so that's how I used to open when I was 16. And that worked because people were nervous. They were like, this is a baby. Why is a baby talking to us?
Maybe this is the joke that you referenced in the tweet. But is there a first joke that you wrote that you knew wasn't going to fly in church, but you were excited about and wanted to tell elsewhere?
Maybe it was that one. I don't know. I don't remember. I don't remember specifically. I do think I tried to do some dead mom jokes pretty early on, and those did not fly at all. So maybe it's those.
Is there anything that you wrote back then about that's sort of related to what you're talking about now, or even in the new hour?
Yeah, for sure. I think even those were hard to make work in comedy clubs. I don't even think that was specific to church. So I think that took a long time. I think I had to get good enough as a stand-up and mature enough as a person to get those to a place where that could work and be funny. Because that's a tough subject to make people laugh about.
Yeah, well, I'm really looking forward to seeing how you do it in your special. I always love hearing about comedians' late night stand-up debuts. And I believe yours was on Conan in 2017. Is that right?
I think so. That sounds right. 2016 or 2017?
What do you remember about that whole experience?
Oh, I mean, that was like the first thing I got. By that point, I had done a few shows, you know, Last Comic and Adam Devine's House Party and stuff. But Conan was the first thing that I really, really wanted that I had grown up watching that was still something that felt relevant and important. And it felt to me, once I had that set, like, okay, I'm a real comedian now because I have a late night set and more specifically a Conan set. So it was great. I mean, I had my two like closest, chillest friends come with me because I was really nervous about it. I ran that set into the ground practicing it and running it around town because I just didn't want to fail. And it's funny because the late night set, it's over so fast. Like you go,
it's like 5 minutes.
You go there. Yeah. You go there at like 2 p.m. and you get your makeup done and you go out, you do it for 5 minutes, you shake Conan's hand, and then like the show's over. Like it's
there's nothing more to it.
Nothing more. It's 4:30 in the afternoon and your day is done. And it's and you're just exhausted for 3 days afterward emotionally because you were thinking about it for so long. I felt ready for it. I felt ready to do it. And it went well, luckily. So it was everything I wanted it to be. I couldn't have asked for a better late night debut. And I, you know, Conan's so funny and like so nice and cool. And it's just, yeah, that was a big moment for me for sure.
Did you get to do panel on Conan before he left or?
They were doing my second stand-up set. I think they were experimenting with like, I don't know how long they did this, but they were experimenting with having only one guest per show. And so I don't know how many of us did this. I think it might have been like only a few, but they did a few where the comedian was the guest. So I did a set and then they had me sit down with them and do panel. So that's the only time that I got to do it. And it was awesome. It was great. And I had already gone on the stand-up tour with Conan that he did. So I knew him a little bit as opposed to the first time where it was like...
So... Finally, I like to give comedians a chance to just shout out anything that's making you laugh really hard now. So what's the last piece of comedy or comedian or someone you want to shout out that just really is making you laugh right now?
Ooh, comedian Brian Simpson, who's a good friend of mine, just recorded his half hour for Netflix. And I got to be there for that to watch it. And he featured for me in Baltimore the weekend before he filmed it. And it's so good. And I think he's just, we started together in San Diego. And I just think he's going to be so huge. And everybody who sees him feels that way. So I'm excited for that to come out so people can watch it. And then in terms of things that make me laugh really hard. Oh, I really got into Rick and Morty this year. That made me laugh. It's really hard for me to find TV shows that make me laugh out loud really hard. Oh, you know what? I know the last thing that made me laugh really hard. So you just watched Sam's documentary, Full Capacity. So there's a part in it where Stavros is doing stand-up and he is talking about, do you know the part I'm talking about?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, where he's talking about, like, the how he looks. He's like, you know, because he's, like, a bigger guy, and he goes, do you think it's easy looking like this? Do you think I only want to do cannonballs?
Yeah, yeah, that was a great line.
No, I want to do other dives. And I obviously watched the documentary with Sam a few times before it came out. I laughed so hard we had to pause it.
That was
and
hysterical.
I have shown people that clip. And before the doc came out, I was like, okay, I'm going to tell you this joke and I'll show you like a clip of him. I don't have this joke, but I'll show you a clip of him so you can picture him saying it. It made me laugh so hard.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was great. Well, thank you so much and congratulations on everything that, you know, all of your success and your tour. And I can't wait to see the new hour when it comes out.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. I love this podcast.
Thank you so much to Taylor Tomlinson for talking with me today. And I love hearing that she is a fan of this podcast. You can get tickets for Taylor's Deal With It tour on her website, ttomcomedy.com. And definitely check out her debut hour, Quarter Life Crisis, on Netflix if you missed it. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes, and see who's coming up next week on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.